This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Dogs don't got teeth like this.
Welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today we are looking at The Monster, Eminem's 2013 hit single with Rihanna. We'll go over some news... No, it's actually the 2016 indie horror film. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then we'll go into this creature, including how burns work, animal-vehicle collisions, and the difference between an alligator and a semaphore. Right? That's it, Libby.
Yeah.
No, allegory and a metaphor. As always, the show's broken up into a few different segments. We'll have the time codes below, so skip ahead to whatever you're looking for. But before we get stuck in, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Adam Hasek, a disease ecologist at the, in Adam's voice today, Ben Gurion University of the UK. Everyone is sick.
Here, yeah. In Israel.
Alongside Adam is the Baroness, her ladyship, Libby Young, a story specialist. And writer and short story soon. And we are rejoined this week by Dave, a vet and a movie physiologist, who alongside me is healthy.
Yay!
Must be nice.
News this week. We'll be a bit late on this. It'll have been out for a week by the time we talk about it. But the IPCC report, specifically that of Working Group 3, came out on Monday. So I say Working Group 3 because the IPCC report as such is actually broken up into three different working groups. I saw a really good summation of it. Working Group 1 is what's fucked. Working Group 2 is how are we fucked. And Working Group 3 is what can we do to unfuck it. Working Group 3's report, which is on the mitigation of climate change, came out last week. And look, it's pretty grim. I'm not going to lie.
How would you expect?
Yeah, and I think it's had, in a lot of places, reasonable coverage. I think that people have talked about this with the urgency it deserves to a large extent. Obviously, there's some exceptions to that. The LA Times had a tiny little segment on the front page that said, Earth on track to be unlivable. Skip to page 3 if you want to check it out. So that's cool. The attention it's getting in some places.
This is literally a headline from Idiocracy. It is insane.
If this causes you to feel nihilism or depression, please don't, because there's so much we can still be doing at this point. There were some really encouraging messages from this report. They talked a lot about some of the countries which have actually decreased their greenhouse gas output recently. They've even talked about countries that have managed to decouple growing economies from growing greenhouse gas emissions, which it's clear evidence that it's a myth that increased consumption comes with increased economic growth.
It's the biggest drawback or the biggest like setback, I would say, to most of this kind of progress, especially in
you know,
where we're from. People ask, yeah, but like, what about jobs? What about the economy? Like the planet? Yeah, whatever. But let's get these jobs first.
We've talked before about the fact that we know the economy will get completely fucked by climate change.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff we can do, and there's a lot of stuff people have been doing, but we need to do it now. There's never been a better time to get active. If you're in a country like Canada or Australia with an election that's coming up soon, and you've got wankers like ScoMo or people who appear pretty good on the surface like Justin Trudeau, demand more from them.
Demand much more.
If you're in a country where it's possible, protest. If you're in a country where it's not possible, there are things you can do on an individual level. We've talked about it before. Turn the heating down if that's an option for you. Use less electricity. If you're in a place where there's safe and accessible public transport, use that as opposed to driving. People talk about electric cars all the time, but I'll tell you what's better than electric cars, not having a car at all. If you can use a bike, if you can use public transport, do that. Cut down on meat. You don't have to
cut down on dairy.
Yeah, cut down on meat, cut down on dairy. You don't have to go vegan. If the whole world ate meat 2 or 3 times less a week, we would be in such a good place right now.
I think, too, something else that's very minuscule, but something that I've incorporated into my daily life is supporting the journalistic representation of these important articles. And so even something as dumb as just clicking on a link, like if you're scrolling through your news and you see an article from NPR about something about the environment or thing, like click on it. Even if you don't want to read it, just click on it, because they view those clicks and they will move from page 3 to page 1. If more people are, or quote, quote, reading them, you know, it's just something, little things that you can do like that too, to sort of help bring this stuff to the forefront, because there's always, this is kind of like the thing that has been on the to-do list for so long now. And it's like the big homework project that you've put off until the last minute. And you're like, well, I gotta, you know, wash the dog first, and I gotta do the dishes, and I gotta do this, because you just really don't want to do this one big thing. You can't put it off forever. And as we know from doing that in our daily lives, things will just keep moving into the forefront. You know, if you put something on the back burner long enough, there's always going to be something, quote, more important to do. And this should be the most important thing.
Even though power washing the dog does take time.
Don't leave it to younger generations too. There's a lot of people who are saying, you know, oh, the Greta Thunbergs of the world will save us. If you're 30, if you're 50, if you're 70, if you're 90, there's still stuff you can do now. Don't wait for the next generation to solve it. We should be solving these problems. We shouldn't be leaving it for our kids or our friends' kids to do.
Not just stuff you can do, stuff you should be doing. This is our responsibility. Yeah,
absolutely. The more sacrifices you make now, the less you're going to have to make later on. Happier news. Well, not happier news. Still fucking miserable. Because of all that Will Smith shit, I completely missed the fact that Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead won People's fucking Choice at the Oscars. Now, I only talk about this because we covered it last year, okay? Generally, I do not give a shit about the Oscars. But what are people doing? That wasn't even Zack Snyder's best movie of the year.
I mean, when you've got a sexy zombie queen and her hunky, shirtless zombie king boyfriend, like, what more do you want from Hollywood?
It's the love story of an age, isn't it? It'll really define a generation, that tale, yeah.
That and fucking, what's-his-face, 40-year-old German playing a teenager, Gunther, or whatever his name was.
Yeah.
He was great.
He was fantastic, wasn't he? Yeah. And good news not good news, it's probably just more cock-teasing, but there's been a recent paper that has suggested that the ivory-billed woodpecker is still out there. So
bullshit.
Yeah. It's a preprint, but yeah, enjoy that tug on your heartstrings, everybody who's hoping for it. Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, a preprint is a repository that is becoming more and more popular nowadays for people to put their, quote, papers on so they can get, quote, cited or read. That hasn't been peer-reviewed, has not been subject to an editor. So take whatever those papers say with a grain of salt until they go through the peer-review process. Because sometimes there are things that need to be edited or changed.
Is this like the MySpace for journal articles?
Adam's being meaner to it than I think it should be. Because Adam's, by saying that things are peer-reviewed, I mean, that does give him a little more credibility. But there are some shit peer-reviewers out there.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I will not say that peer review is perfect, but it is the best we have, and I think it is a very important process in the acquisition and learning of scientific knowledge. So without doing that, it's doing the paper a disservice. The reason that I say that with so much smarm in my voice, especially with the ivory-billed woodpecker, is this is a bird that has been extinct for at least 100 years, probably, but definitely has not been seen since the early 1900s. It was a very large, very beautiful woodpecker species that people, especially in Arkansas, where Libby and I were last, really loved to say that they saw recently. And I, because I was not aware about birds at the time, thought I saw one once, and I got really excited, and I texted my advisor, and he said, no, you didn't fucking see that. I said, all right, I'll keep that in mind. While not as well known or as unfortunate as the thylacine or the Tasmanian tiger, it is a species that people will say they saw all the time. You didn't see one. It was probably a pileated woodpecker.
Have I slathered us with enough news now, or has anybody got enough?
I have one bit of news.
Have a new?
I have a new.
Libby, I hear you have a news.
a scientist at the University of West England inserted electrodes into four species of fungi and discovered that mushrooms seem to use electrical impulses to communicate internally with as many as 50 words.
Words! They've quantified the vocab of mushrooms. Wow.
That's really fucking cool. Although I will say, the University of West England sounds like a child's version of, where'd you go to school? West England, and I'm going to school so I can learn business.
Yeah. This is obviously going to be quite revolutionary research now, but I will point out that when similar research first surfaced about trees, the woman who brought that research up was ridiculed at the time. And this happened in the, I think it was the 80s and 90s. There's a fictionalized version of it that takes place in a book that I've talked about before, Richard Powers' The Overstory. She was ridiculed at the time. I'm trying to find a name. But yeah, 20 years later, it turned out she was absolutely right. And everybody, you know,
ate their shorts.
Yeah, if a tree starts being attacked in one place, it will release hormones or pheromones? Or
back.
Yeah, and they will increase production of compounds which will make their leaves more difficult to digest and chew, increasing their defense against insects and other predators.
Nice.
If you've ever read the Jurassic Park novel, Ellie Sattler's first little bit about why plants are so interesting with all their biological chemical warfare against one another is really cool, and it's a fairly accurate summation of how plants actually interact with one another in nature. And to Sam's point, a lot of the research I've been doing through my own studies of parasites involves looking at a lot of the research people do within the agricultural sector. So they study how plants release these volatile compounds whenever herbivorous insects come and start to eat them. And these compounds that are released will attract parasitoids, which come and lay their babies inside of these insects and kill them. So the plant's like, hey, come get your friend.
That is so fucking cool. I've never heard of that before. That's amazing.
It's gnarly.
It's cool.
I was going to clarify that trees use the wood wide web to communicate.
Shut the fuck up.
And just to, I have found the woman's name. Her name is Dr. Suzanne Simard. Simard. She's a Canadian scientist from the University of British Columbia.
Plants have a chemistry to do this. They release co-transporters into the air.
You think it could be plants?
Feel this movie's allegory run over you like a station wagon runs over a wolf on a dark country road. A monster, I mean abusive mother, drives her young daughter to another monster, I mean her equally shitty dad, in the middle of the night. Just like their relationship with each other, their journey gets derailed by an accident and subsequent breakdown. This mom is a bitch, and so is timing, as they happen to break down at the exact moment a shark-toothed creature is on the prowl. Just like anyone that's probably tried to help these two out in the past, the people who come to rescue them, including the world's slowest ambulance, get slaughtered in their wake. As if this poor girl's life has not been traumatic enough, she gets to witness the brutal death of her mom. But that's okay, because the allegory saves the day. As she's finally free of her abuser, she finds the will to finally stand up to the monster, the creature, not her mom, or her dad, and defeats it, finally stepping out of the dark, twisted woods and into the light.
Was her dad a bad guy?
If he's leaving her with the mother, he should not be letting her stay with that mother at all.
Yeah, somebody's not equipped to have kids.
What do we like about this one? Dave, I feel like you haven't gone first in a long time.
I liked the monster in terms of the creature that attacks. I like the shittiness and the commitment to the shittiness of the mum. Like, they're really didn't feel like there was a giant redemption arc, quite the opposite, and I think we'll get into that as we go. Where it's not like we finish off and it's like, oh, she's done such a good job at protecting her. She made one big final act to try and like save her. Like, in fact, her final act is stupid. And I feel the movie does highlight that it is kind of a dumb move on her part. I also, the gore element of this, particularly the truck driver missing the arm, dragging himself up to the truck and trying to get in, actually felt like one of the most, I mean, he should be bleeding out way faster, but it felt like one of the most realistic interpretations of a really injured man. Like, he's not just, like, running around with his arm gone as he tries to get into the truck. Like, he is fucked up. And it doesn't matter how much they yell at him or bang on the horn or anything like that. Physiologically, the human body can only take so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think for a movie that only cost $3 million, it looked great, I feel like, by and large. I felt they did a lot of, quote, natural lighting, even though there was obviously, you know, lights there for production. It was really tense for most of the way through for a movie that I thought was not going to be that great. I had a really good time with it, and the monster was fun. My favorite kind of scary movies are monster movies. I don't really care for ghost stuff, cult stuff, any of that, but give me a good setting with a interesting monster and a fun premise, you know, car breaking down on the road, and guess what? Fucking bat gorilla wolf motherfucker is right there waiting to chomp your bits. And that's great.
I really liked some of the fight scenes from Zoe Kazan. I felt like it was very believable abuse, which I don't know why I like that or what that says about me. but that was about it.
I thought the two main performances in this were amazing. I thought Zoe Kazan and Ella Ballantyne were fantastic. I thought there was really real chemistry between them. I totally bought them as a, you know, really fractured mother and daughter. If you can even call them a mother and daughter at this phase, because she's obviously, you know, transitioning away from seeing this woman as her guardian. Even though it does come back to that. Like, I like the fact that at the end of the movie, despite the fact that she does make a silly decision.
Silly.
It's easy for us to sit here and be like, well, I would have done this in this situation when, you know, you've got a heavily traumatized woman just trying to, you know, make a decision to keep her daughter alive and not thinking particularly straight and bleeding to death. But I do think that her act at the end shows that she is still trying to be a mother, and that the kid who is, you know, striving for independence, at the end of the day, she's just a really frightened kid. And, you know, I thought that they pulled that off really well, both of them. It was just really nice to genuinely enjoy a horror film, as opposed to, you know, enjoy it because it's a bit trashy.
Yeah.
What did we like?
I mean, I think we've covered to a certain degree, and maybe we'll talk about it more as we go through the... her trying to save her daughter by running off into the woods not that far away and then putting out the torch to get attacked by this thing and be like, run home down the road in the dark with this super fast creature. Don't get me wrong, she's a traumatized woman. I don't know, Sam, you're a parent. Would your first instinct be to like leave your kid alone in the dark to run from the monster?
I am sitting safe in my study with my son upstairs also sitting safe. I've never been in this sort of situation before. I've never been fucking bleeding out knowing I'm going to die. This woman also doesn't seem to have a shit together even when she is not in the middle of the woods.
Let's just say this isn't the first time she's probably abandoned her child.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Not in the least.
The last two points I was just going to make are, I'm kind of getting tired of movies showing humans with dried blood on their face without actually ever showing them bleeding. Like the ambulance flips over and all the characters get all beat up, and then they're all getting up and all the blood has like stopped and dried, and she's like, oh, but I'm bleeding out. And I'm like, are you? Or are you just coagulating at a hyper? Are you Wolverine? And then to agree with Libby's point, and I'm sure Libby will take more to this, where the fuck are the police? The ambulance calls, like you hear them talking to a dispatcher and they're like, get the police out here. We've got like a fucking dead
animal
body.
Control.
Also, any dispatcher worth their salt would never hang up on a child. They would stay on the line with that child until help got there.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Especially when panicking that fucking much and obviously in a really bad situation. For me, though I enjoyed this movie overall quite a bit and a lot more than I thought I was going to, the budget was very limited and very small, and that was very apparent with the end monster reveal at the end of literal dude in a suit. And like,
not even looking very animalistic, just crouching.
No, just looking very like 80s monster movie.
It reminded me of Alien in the Shaft when he gives jazz hands. That's like my favorite scene in Alien.
Which is still great, but... yeah. Like the weird like baggy trash bag wing things hanging down between its forelegs and its back. Like, what is that? Why aren't you showing it more? What is the deal? But my real biggest issue, these people are inside of a car, outside of a car, in the pouring rain, in the woods, talking at a normal conversational register, expecting someone to fucking hear them. I know some people don't have the best hearing, but people have trouble hearing you if you're in the car, much less outside of the car, much less in a downpour, much less underneath the car in a downpour while you're in the car.
Oh. Hey, Mr. Jesse. Mr. Jesse, come on.
Hey, Mom, I'm in the woods a good 40 meters down the road from you. Why can't you hear me? Yeah. I called for you.
In the rainstorm.
You never listen to me.
I feel this movie was formulaic and painfully allegorical. This is like the C version of Babadook, is what I equated it to.
Ooh, not even the B version.
No, the C version. There's a term called CIS, called character-induced stupidity. So there's about 17 things that no person or professional would ever do if they were in this situation. We've talked about a few of them already. I feel a little opposite of you, Sam. While I really liked the main, the mom, her acting was really good to me. The child actor was painful for me to watch.
Really?
She was very bad to me. And I felt like it took me out of the scene every time was in it. So
The fuck you scene back and forth standing in the driveway between Zoe's son and the daughter.
God.
Oh, I really liked that. I thought that was well done.
I thought it was good as well. Yeah, but I just hated it in terms of like, oh my God, you're the worst mother ever. I just fucking... in terms of what I didn't like, I totally agree with Adam. I think the final reveal of the monster was a bit lame. I think they should have really saved that for... I think they should have just kept it not fully revealed for the entire movie.
You didn't need it there.
Yeah. You don't need, like, the full corporeal form of the... Corporeal.
It was a body.
The full physical form of the monster isn't the thing that's driving the scares and the tension here. I don't think you needed to show it. And especially not in that way. Yeah.
I think the most you ever needed to see was that thing fucking reaching in the car and yoinking her ass straight out the window. That was an incredible scene.
Yeah. And a lot of the scares here, you know they're coming, but I didn't feel like it made them any less effective. Like, you know that a hand's coming down through that window to yank them out.
What a twist!
Okay, trivia. So I've already shown we have mixed thoughts on the main two actors. What I think was really interesting was that Zoe Kazan, who plays the older woman,
the mother,
who plays the mum,
ancient woman.
People might know her from The Big Sick.
She's in The Big Sick.
Yeah, she was the female lead in The Big Sick.
Oh, okay, she plays Emily B. Gordon's part.
Yeah. And she actually asked, this sounds a bit creepy when I say it, but obviously, you know, we're put in context, so it's fine. She asked for baby pictures of Ella Ballantyne to kind of, you know, improve that familial bond, because it was basically this was filmed in a really remote part of Ontario, and it was just those two plus Ella Ballantyne's mum out in that area for long periods of time, so they really got to know each other. And Zoe Kazan actually had a really hard time with the character she was playing.
I bet.
Yeah, because the kid seemed like, you know, such a sweet kid, so she was just thinking, what the fuck is wrong with this Kathy person? Like, why is she such an asshole? I think it's an incredible performance, and she actually ended up having a kid 2 years after this this film. So
cool. Yeah.
With Paul Dano.
If you've ever seen Ruby Sparks, the two of them are fantastic in that. Fantastic film with the two of them in it. Definitely not a surprise.
Speaking of Zoe Kazan, this role was actually originally intended for Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah.
And the movie was actually originally titled There Are Monsters, which I think is better.
Much better.
Yeah, but I maintain that there was some dumbass studio head who said, well, actually, there's only one monster, so it has to be There Is Monster. Yeah, I think There Are Monsters is a better film title.
Especially with the little fable story like at the beginning. Like,
and the sign-off at the end, I think it makes way more sense. Yeah. And also, Scott Speedman, like we've already talked about, who people may know from Underworld, he's in this movie for 5 seconds.
And he's great in it.
He seems so fucking scary. Yeah.
Production actually built a paved stretch of road with working street lamps for filming. So street wasn't really a street. It was just this huge section of paved road that they made.
Interesting.
This is
what?
one of those things where it's just like, is it more expensive to hire out an existing road than to build an entirely new road?
Yes.
Absolutely.
It's like a low-budget version of that whole Christopher Nolan thing in Tenet, where it was more expensive to CGI blowing up a plane than to actually blow up a fucking plane.
In their defense,
I feel like... No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I remember as a grad student walking home from the lab one time at 11 p.m. and they blocked off a big section of my normal walk home because they were filming Pixels. And I kept thinking to myself, fuck you, I have to detour for this shitty Adam Sandler movie. Fuck your movie, I don't want to walk around. So I can understand them not wanting to deal with people like me and being like, fuck it, we're just going to build a separate road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes a lot more sense now, especially given like what they were trying to show with the movie of giving you some light. But at least in the U.S., and I can't speak for Canada, seeing a lit back road like that was really bizarre. It took me out of the movie. Like, yeah. I mentioned it to Libby when we were watching it. Like, why are there lights out here in the middle of fucking nowhere? I know if I'm in a civilized country like Sweden, they have bike paths between the villages that have, you know, lights on them, and it's lovely. But that's also a civilized country, unlike the U.S.
The last bit of trivia I have is in the monster a la flambe scene, you can actually see the monster's human hand from the actor in the suit. It was a little goof.
That's hilarious.
Little whoopsie-doo.
So the comment about the road being built for this, just for that the movie itself, made me think that's probably where most of the budget for this movie went. Yeah. And I found it very interesting because you talk about these like smaller indie movies that don't really go anywhere, and people are like, yeah, of course not. Well, to put things into a bit of perspective for the listeners if they don't already know, The Monster had a budget of $3 million, and it unfortunately only made $74,700, so less than one-third of what they paid for it. But these movies sometimes do go really well, and in a very, not necessarily in subject material, but in the way it was filmed, Saw, the first Saw, had a budget of $1.2 million. It was basically a student film. Filmed in one room, somehow they got Cary Elwes in it, and that movie made over $100 million. So,
or
sometimes you hit it, sometimes you don't.
Or my favorite example is
so weird saying only $1.2 million.
Yeah, or my favorite example is One Cut of the Dead. Yeah.
That was what, $24,000.
It was some. It was like $36,000 or something. I can't even remember, and they've made like $36 million.
That movie is incredible. Again, listeners, if you haven't seen it, don't look up anything about it. Just watch it. It's so good.
And this is the reason why there's like 17 different Paranormal Activity films. It's because they cost nothing to make and they make $20 million every time.
Yeah.
My girlfriend, Katie, she thinks there's something in the house. I don't know.
You believe me, right?
So, before we start looking at the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Hasik Adam. If you want to get in touch with us, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord and check out our fresh memes. You can find the link to the server in the episode description or on our website. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and read a titillating buttload of short stories. And if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore, less movie-related ecology that Adam and I write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com and check out our work along with the work of a massive cornucopia of international writers. This beast, there's nothing that extreme about it. It's got kind of a canid face, maybe halfway between a wolf and a bear. The teeth are bigger and a lot more extravagant than most.
Look like venom teeth.
Yeah.
Just
but they're
about.
Not that overdone. Yeah, I mean, they've still got the typical kind of two massive long canines, smaller ones in between and behind. It's not comparable to anything.
I would say the teeth are comparable. It's just the sheer amount and size of them all together in one mouth is a bit over excessive. But yeah. You would expect to see teeth like that in a tiger, a saber-toothed cat, maybe some
Andrew
of the...
Andrew Sarkis.
Yeah, cave bears. They would have all had similarly enormous teeth, but just all of those had a very freaky night at a Motel 6, and then this thing came out.
We also didn't see a broken tooth that would have been left behind in the wolf.
I was looking for it.
One thing I thought was very weird about this is that at no point did the mother or daughter think, oh, it's probably a bear. Because obviously they would have been wrong, but isn't that what you jump to?
That's what I would have.
I don't know. I probably would have thought like another wolf killed it, because I mean, I obviously have a bit of a bias because I study ecology and I have a very basic idea of what wolf interactions typically go like. So I wouldn't think a predator took it out, but at the very least, I'm staying in that fucking car until somebody comes, because there's obviously something else out there.
Yeah, I would have thought it was just like, you know, from a fresh kill or something.
Yeah.
That's why it's all bloody. You don't see a bloody wolf and assume that something's attacked it. You would assume it's attacked something.
That's a good point.
But, I mean, this thing moves very fast, obviously. I mean, it runs down a speeding ambulance. Grizzly bears move insanely quickly. Grizzly bears can get to, like, 60, 65 kilometers an hour. But this thing, I mean, I'm assuming that Zoe Kazan is, like, stepping on it to get the hell out of there. And this thing chases it down. And I mean, it comes at it from a 90-degree angle.
From the side, yeah. And ambulances fucking scoot for good reason.
Dude, I was about to say, how fast do they accelerate?
Both wolves and bears can move very fast, but not this fast. I mean, it is an exaggeration, but it's not too much. Like I said, the only thing that really does this is a disservice is the fact that it's a man in a suit and we see that crouching position. And also the hairlessness. I mean, there is a reason that every other mammal in this part of the world, which I'm assuming is the northern United States or southern Canada, there's a reason that every other mammal there that's large and above ground has fur.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, it's cold.
Even the underground ones have fur. Moles, voles, mice, gerbils. Bats. They all have fur. I don't think they're gerbils in North America, but... No.
Yeah.
Yeah, bats.
You need a furry coat to get you through winter.
I would also argue hitting the ambulance and knocking it over... a little bit unrealistic. Most of the time, if you hit a moose or a deer or any other animal with your car, like, yeah, there's some windshield damage, but it doesn't flip your vehicle.
No. I mean, it'll stop your vehicle. If you hit a moose, you are fucked. Like, that car is not going very far afterwards. Kangaroos as well. Like, they are pretty much just pure muscle. So if you hit, like, a big red out in, like, the middle of the west of Australia...
good luck.
Yeah, you're in deep shit. Yeah.
It'll pull you out. But this thing, like,
comes at it from the side.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, obviously, physics is a hell of a thing, and force equals mass times acceleration, so this thing looks to weigh at least 100 kilograms, if not more, and depending on how fast it's going, hitting the side at the right angle, ambulances tend to be a little top-heavy. Maybe it just happened, if she's at mid-swerve and kind of the weight is already on one side and you hit it from the other one.
But then our monster wouldn't look good after.
No.
No, that's one of the things people tend to not think about with these types of, like, vehicular accidents with animals. Where if you hit a deer or a moose, unfortunately, the deer is, and the animal is usually injured, unless it's a moose, because it'll just go on its merry way and maybe stomp your car on the way out for good measure. But the reason your car gets so fucked up is because there's an equal and opposite reaction. Whatever you do to that deer is happening to your car as well. So it's...
yeah.
That monster would have been fucked.
And at first glance, this seems to be a solo predator. Because, I mean, look, it doesn't need all that meat.
No.
It's, you know, killed a wolf already. If it's going to eat that, I mean, it's killed Jesse. So it's obviously killing these because it's territorial. And I was thinking that, you know, it was a solo predator with just a pretty large home range that it defends pretty aggressively. But Adam, you had another theory, which kind of also might solve the fact that it ran that fast and chased the ambulance down.
The behavior of this animal outside of sheer territoriality does not fit for a single individual. I think what's more likely is we have a group of these predators working together, much like a wolf would or a pack of wolves would. And this also fits within the universe of instead of the directors or the movie people making a mistake and not having a missing tooth from the mouth of the monster, it was a different individual that lost his tooth in the wolf. There is no reason why a predator would sneak up on an unsuspecting prey, monster behind a little girl, and then just leave for dramatic effect. Like, I'll get your ass later. Don't you worry about it. I'm just going to make you feel scared for a second because you taste better. No, if a predator has you, it's going to have you. Like, a tiger just doesn't give up and, like, tag you and say, ha, gotcha. You're dead. It's just over. And I think especially if it's in a pack dynamic, it's a fair assumption to say that a more dominant or aggressive individual drove that one off from killing the little girl before they had the chance to do it. And the one that dragged away Jesse would have been maybe a different one than ripped his arm off. The one that dragged Jesse away was easily, having fun chomping away on that poor mechanic who came out in the middle of the fucking night in the rain underneath this car in all of this oil that's all over the road to have a little girl yell at him about a cell phone, like, give the man a break, and he got eaten alive.
I do like Adam's concept.
Yeah, I think
though, if it turns out that the pack is trying to encourage like one of their younger members to take on the little girl to try and help with like training and teaching it, and they're like, come on, Carl, you've got this. Eat the little girl. Sets it on fire, and they're like, we made a bad decision there.
Also changes the allegorical nature of the movie, doesn't it? If she like she comes out of the woods into the light and then...
That was the director's cut.
That's the exact dialogue from the transcript.
Nom, 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 nom,
nom, nom. This monster dies via burns. Of course, a bunch of roasters stand around it and just make fun of its physical appearance, and it just gets shamed to death. You know, there's some sick burns.
It happens.
A group of mean girls picking on it. Talking about the creature getting burned to death, I figured that because there's not really a lot physiologically in this episode we haven't talked about before, a lot of which we've covered for this type of creature in our big hairy gorilla wolf motherfuckers. Is that what we called the creatures from
Attack? Big gorilla wolf motherfuckers.
I allow it, bruv.
Mayhem and props.
Right.
I was just about to quote it.
One of the key moments that takes place in this film is where our lead female character, the daughter, not the mom, ends up getting the monster into the ambulance, soaking it with some type of flammable antiseptic spray.
Does she soak it? All I saw was a quick hairspray, and all of a sudden it is engulfed in flame.
This thing has very flaming skin.
I also don't have a great explanation for why she didn't soak it and light it on fire when it was in the fucking ambulance, distracted by the toy that she'd thrown. Instead, she then lures it outside of the ambulance where she can flamethrower it then.
You couldn't have gotten that amazing shot of the man in the suit squatting on his haunches.
So,
and her saying, I'm not scared of you. Come on.
The creature is burned and dies very quickly, which is actually within the realm of possibility.
Are you saying it's in the realm of possibility that if you set a thing on fire, it'll die? That seems highly unlikely, Dave.
Next week's episode, we'll tell you the water's wet.
It'll die rapidly, because there are very few things that will kill you that quickly. Chemical burns will kill you pretty quick. So skin, broken up into a couple of different categories. The outside surface of the skin is your epidermis. That's the part that has your melanocytes. Hey, it's got thickened keratin.
Hey, Dave.
The underlying layer of your skin.
Your epidermis is showing.
I was just thinking, like, 15-year-old boys would be able to take this monster easily. Do you remember when, like, you'd be at a party and you get, like, a can of deodorant and a lighter and, like...
Yeah.
Or just a fart. Like, just a good fart. A lighter.
Changes the tone of the movie, doesn't it? If she beats it by fucking letting one rip.
That'd be impossible because girls don't fart, so she'd be dead. Yeah.
That's a good point.
Also, flames come back. A lot of times with those spray things, if you set something on fire and you don't know what you're doing with a spray material, it'll come back into the canister. There is... it's not like that was designed for a flame, regardless. So the epidermis is the outside surface of the skin. The dermis forms the lower layers. That's got your blood vessels, your lymph vessels, your sweat glands. And then right below that is the subcutis. It's sort of the deepest layer of the skin. It's got your collagen, your fat cells. It helps to conserve the body's heat. It's your shock absorber. Some of us have more of it than others. COVID has been hard on us all. Now, skin...
Times are rough.
Skin plays a variety of different roles in the body, from regulating your temperature to preventing water loss to sensory function, right? When touching and feeling when something is burning you. In terms of the classification of burns, first degree burns are those that basically just affect the epidermis, the outside surface. Second degree burns extend into the dermis. And then third degree burns are full thickness. They go through the epidermis, through the dermis, into the subcutis and right down to the layer.
Char.
Yeah. Third degree burns, we are down to the layer that allows you to produce more skin. That's why we need grafts and other extensive processes. If
Adam and I have 3 degrees.
Wait, so sorry, if you make a comment to someone then, do you refer to that as a third degree burn afterward?
Yes.
When intensive burning takes place, the biggest risks that occur are as follows. So bacterial infection, your skin protects you. Animals very rapidly go into sepsis. I do not think that's what's taking place here with our creature. The more concerning ones are you can go into various forms of shock. So if you get extreme forms of burn, basically your blood volume is going to potentially be altered, as well as your ability to hold in fluids. You will not be able to conserve body temperature. You go hypothermic really rapidly. You would think that you get burned and you're like, oh, you get burned and you get put out. Your temperature is going to be really high. Yeah, initially. And then you're going to start bleeding body heat from whatever areas are extensively burned. The thing that I think kills this in the absolute worst part about burning, breathing problems. If you inhale or intake smoke or other chemical inhalants, she hits this thing in the face with the chemical compound that she's using. Sorry. If it takes it in and basically it's experiencing pulmonary burns into the lining of its lungs, fuck, that's going to hurt.
It can't breathe anymore.
Nope. Now, it'll go into shock. And I mean, at a very basic definition, shock is just a situation in which your body is not able to meet its energy demands, where cells aren't getting the energy that it needs, whether or not that's oxygen, blood supply, sugar, whatever it might be. The worst part I kept thinking about this whole thing is, so she's likely hit it in the face with the fire. It's probably breathed it in and it's gone into shock, as well as extensive damage across its body, secondary to the burns she's triggered. When it tries to get up at the end, I was thinking, no, fuck. Like, it's not going to die instantaneously, right? Life really does fight on. We like this idea of there are these certain things that'll kill you really quickly. It's really rare in nature to find something outside of a chemical agent that we can introduce that kills you pretty much immediately.
What about having your head chopped off?
Head chopped off? Well, but talk to the chicken that runs around for a while with its head chopped off. I don't think it's dead. I think at the end when she walks off, we've got a creature that is probably in extreme forms of shock. It will be dead soonish, but she basically burns it and then she hits it repeatedly with a stick and then leaves it for dead in the bushes.
Well, I will say, as someone who went to the emergency room as a child because my sister threw a stick into my eye, don't underestimate the amount of damage that a little girl can do with a stick.
Yeah. Again, I know that... A couple of you have criticized this, but I like the bad decisions they've made that are clearly just born of desperation. Like, she's not looking around for a shovel or a knife. She's just, the only thing she's got at hand is a stick. And she's like, right, I'm going to beat this thing with a stick.
So she doesn't beat it in the head.
No.
She beats it, like, on the side.
Right, on the burned bits, though. I mean, I feel like the creature got hit a couple of times and was like, I'm just going to lie still. This really hurts.
I do have a question for you, Dave. What... I mean, because she doesn't soak it with chemicals, what would make skin, like, go up so quickly like that? Like, that was when I was watching, I was like, that thing caught on fire fast, and it, like, stayed lit. I've seen my cat dip its tail into a candle a few times, and it does catch fire, but it kind of almost puts itself out. So I'm wondering, like, what made it... And the cat doesn't even notice. I know, they don't even notice. I'm wondering just, like, what made it... you know, catch fire so quickly and then stay lit as well.
Yeah, so the only thing I could think of while watching this is that this girl got incredibly lucky. The ambulance is turned over. If the ambulance is leaking fuel and the creature has basically climbed its way through the gasoline on its way into the cab to go after the little girl, is the only way this thing would have gone up at the rate that it did. Otherwise, she would have just sprayed fire into its face. But I think she got really lucky. I think it climbed through some of the gasoline, didn't realize what it was doing, got into the vehicle, and she was like, oh, I'm so good with fire. And I'm like, you are so fucking lucky.
I knew this would work.
I mean, maybe this is like a weird fucking mutant species thing that we haven't quite figured out yet, but there are organisms that produce very strange, to us, strange chemicals, like... The, I think it's 1996 movie, The Beast, is about a giant squid. It's like, it's Jaws, but it's a giant squid. And in that movie, they talk about how it always reeks of ammonia. And the giant squid sweats ammonia. And giant squids do produce, or they keep ammonia in their muscular tissues as a way to kind of help with buoyancy. And so they smell like ammonia. And while it's not very flammable, maybe this organism, I don't know how it could do it as a mammal, sweats or produces some kind of chemical, much like an ammonia type thing that would actually be flammable. And so it would immediately go right up.
It just wouldn't be common. And I don't think there'd be a good evolutionary basis. We've talked about before, the problem we have with dragons is it's fucking fire. Everything has learned to stay away from fire. One of my favorite comments of any of the DC universe will still be the Robot Chicken episode where Batman's showing off all the weaknesses he's got for the various yeah. superheroes. And he gets to the Martian Manhunter and Robin chimes in and he's like, fire! Yeah, it's his number one weakness. And Batman turns to him and he goes, yeah, it's fire. It's everybody's weakness. There is static electricity that takes place all the time in nature. I do not look forward to the poor creature that starts secreting some sort of flammable compound onto its skin and just happens to walk across a carpeted surface and goes up in flames. I don't feel that it's probably going to spread its genetics very readily.
No, not unless there is a very, very strong advantage conveyed by whatever substance that was. And I couldn't tell you what that is at this point.
Now, another alternative that would fit with some of Adam's beliefs are depending on what area of the U.S. they are in, and depending on how corrosive or flammable the rain is that's coming down based on the localized chemical pollution, it might just be that this thing stood in the rain long enough to potentially be flammable.
I mean, acid rain's a thing.
Yeah. We had a lot of acid rain in the Norway in like the 70s and 80s. A lot of ecosystems are only just recovering. Like they've had to lime waterways here extensively. Obviously, the main tension of this film is kicked off by a wolf getting hit by a car. Now, in general, carnivores are pretty smart and don't tend to hang around roads that much. They're not studied as much, though. But vehicle collisions are still a massive cause of death for carnivores worldwide. Half of all puma deaths in Florida are caused by cars, recorded deaths, that is. Wolves will actively avoid roads. They'll avoid establishing home ranges in areas with high road density. But, I mean, we're everywhere these days. So it still happens that, you know, wolves end up in areas where there's plenty of roads around. And in Italy, there's been pretty extensive surveys of recorded wolf deaths. A lot of them are down to poisonings, trappings, huntings, but about 50% between 1990 and 2000 were caused by collisions. So a wolf wandering out into the middle of the road and getting hit, absolutely within the realm of possibility. In an isolated area like this, less likely, because like I said, wolves can learn to stay away from roads. You know, they do so on a regular basis. So I don't think it would really happen. The monster hanging out near the road as well, I don't think that's the case either. Even a monster like this, it would not be going after cars. Like, it's going to want to stay the hell away from roads most of the time.
Yeah, it's just a matter of happenstance that the wolf happened to get chased towards the road, wandered out, got hit, and the monster decided it was going to stay around for more prey.
But the reason I want to talk about this is because a road might not seem much to us because we cross them all the time. It looks like a pretty easy thing to cross. But just putting a road in the middle of an area creates massive amounts of habitat fragmentation. Just because something you think can disperse over it quite easily doesn't mean it's going to. Even if a road is heavily underused, doesn't necessarily mean that creatures are going to want to cross it willingly.
I mean,
especially carnivores, which tend to be a little smarter.
Think about it like this. You have a lot of people think that birds are and flying insects are able to just go anywhere, do whatever they want. If you have a forest and forest on one side, forest on the other, and in between those is a meadow, a lot of species are not going to be able to cross that meadow because they're not adapted for it, they don't know how to do it, or they purposely avoid it because it puts them in the open where a predator is going to snatch them immediately. If there aren't like connected forests, there's no way those species are going to be able to get from one side to the other. And that's just a meadow, a natural setting. Now compare that to a fucking asphalt-covered, human chemical-produced road.
If you want to watch a very depressing documentary about habitat fragmentation due to human construction and particularly roads, there is a documentary called The Last Green Thread about the Florida Everglades. I think it was put on by REI, the outdoor company. But it is really good, but be prepared to cry.
And if you want to cry even harder, go and watch The Animals of Farthingwood.
Oh, you got to stop bringing that up.
So fucked. I can't believe I watched that as a kid and wasn't scarred for life. Well, that's the jury remains out on that one.
Yeah.
The fact is that, like I'm saying, there's lots of deaths that take place because of these animal collisions, but the habitat fragmentation that roads represent is a much bigger threat to populations long term. And the fact is that most management efforts, they're not focused on helping out these populations or conservation. They're focused on saving human lives, which, totally understandable. And you know what really prevents collisions is a fence. But a fence does a hell of a lot more damage when it comes to fragmentation. So what has been happening, and this is a conservation effort that's been happening for a while, is old overpasses, underpasses, even new ones have been constructed. They're just turned into animal crossings in different parts of the world all over the place. And these are really effective. They've been really effective for a long time. We know they work. Every now and then things go wrong. We had a moose turn up in our neighborhood August last year, which is not a good place for a moose to be. As much as I like to think of myself as living in the suburbs, it's not that rural at all. So, you know, a moose turning up here is going to be confused and not able to get out, but it does show that they're able to move a little more freely. As a last tidbit, I just want to throw in here that the reintroduction of wolves, like Adam was saying, a lot of herbivores stay the hell away from open areas, especially if they know there's wolves around, because they're much more vulnerable. Reintroducing wolves into areas reduces animal collisions, not even by reducing the population of herbivores, but by changing the behavior of those herbivores to keep them away from open areas. So if you have wolves in your area, then herbivores are less likely to venture out onto roads. They're less likely to get hit. They're less likely to put humans in danger. Yep.
Exactly.
Now we know.
And knowing is half the battle.
Eating carnivores. So we've established that this thing is probably just territorial and is probably just killing the wolf because it ventured into its territory. But in general, I mean, they will eat meat if it's available, but carnivores tend to avoid eating other carnivores as a general trend. Biomagnification is whereby the buildup of, it could be anything from heavy metals to pathogens, happens as you go further up the food chain. So we know how many microplastics, how many heavy metals there are in the oceans these days. At the lowest level, so within the ocean itself, very low concentration, but within a fish that's eating algae or swimming through filter feeding, it's going to be slightly higher. Carnivorous fish that prey on the smaller fish, again, that concentration of heavy metals is going to be slightly higher. So as you keep going up the food chain, you've got a higher risk of heavy metal poisoning and of picking up infectious diseases. Right, Adam? You're the disease ecologist. I feel like you're...
It's one of those things where it's going to depend on the system in question you're looking at. But often you have a lot of parasites that have adapted to depend on the host, on an intermediate host being consumed by a final host. So you have a parasite that will infect snails. Those snails will be used as a factory to produce more infective stages. They put those in the water. Tadpoles and or fish will eat those infective stages, become infected themselves. And then the bird, which is the final host, eats one of those individuals, and the parasite can then finish its life cycle in there. So in that case, this is where you see parasites kind of moving up the food web or moving up the trophic system. But there's also a train of thought where intra-guild predation or cannibalism, so species that are on the same trophic level, so one predator and another predator eating each other, and if it's the same species, it's cannibalism, that can actually reduce disease dynamics, because if it's not a parasite that is transmitted by, you know, by the trophic cascade, by being eaten, you know, by a predator further up, it will, the parasite just kind of dies with its host, so it will reduce disease dynamics within the population. So it depends on the system you're looking at.
Yeah, it does. It does absolutely still happen. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that this thing would drag the wolf off to eat it.
There's also, there's not a lot of energy available. You have, if you think there's the energy is lost as you move further and further up the trophic system. So if you imagine grass has 1,000 calories and caterpillars eat that grass, only 100 of those calories will be available as energy from that caterpillar. And if you eat that caterpillar, you're only going to get 10 calories from it. So as energy, that is.
But I mean, it's not to say that we never eat carnivores. Alligator and crocodile are delicacies in part of the world. Snake. I've had snake in Vietnam before. And the thing is, most of the fish we eat are carnivores. Tuna is a carnivorous fish.
A crazy good predator.
Yeah. Swordfish. I mean, flake. Shark is a pretty common. Yeah. Most of the fish we eat are carnivores. So it does happen, but we have tended to stay away from them in the past. Also, I mean, they're just harder to come across a lot of the time.
Lower population densities.
Nom nom.
So I wanted to feature a news story spotlight today called, well, When I educate or remind our listeners about literature terms or devices that we might have forgotten from our sixth grade English class, and I'm going to call it Literature 101. So today we are going over some definitions of terms related to the lovely allegory. First, we have the classic allegory, which a lot of people get confused or shorthand title it with metaphor. Right, we use the word metaphor a lot, like, oh, it's a metaphor for this or metaphor for that. But a lot of times what we mean is allegory, actually. So allegory is a subtle or hidden message within a storyline. The message is rarely, if at all, mentioned by the author, but rather it's up to the reader to interpret the double meaning. Authors use this to convey deep truths, important insights, or pressing commentary, or just to teach lessons about life, morality, politics, etc. It's figurative rather than literal, a show rather than tell. So kind of the classic examples of allegories that we've read in sixth grade English class are Animal Farm, Chronicles of Narnia, Aesop's Fables, Lord of the Flies, The Scarlet Letter. Like, those are all really popular allegorical tales. And so when crafting an allegorical fiction, a writer might use several tools to accomplish this goal, and one of these tools would be the metaphor. So the metaphor is a figure of speech that describes something, an object or an action, in the way that isn't really true, but uses comparisons, I'm English, uses comparisons or symbolisms.
Comparisations.
Yes, there it is, to describe something. Metaphors are interwoven in our speech so much that we don't even think about them. Like, when's the last time you said, that broke my heart, or I devoured a good book, or you found yourself, quote, a bit prickly and irritable? All of those things are metaphors that we use sort of on a daily basis.
It's actually an Australian tradition to eat a book after you've read it.
Literally devour.
Do you not do that in America?
that explains a lot of things, actually.
We have a very high tolerance for cellulose.
All those stories I heard about toilet water in Australia going backwards is wrong. It's just the toilets don't go because of the high-fiber book diets.
Another lit tool is personification, not to be confused with anthropomorphism. So these are two that also sort of get mixed up. Personification is the attribution of a personal nature or human characteristic to something non-human. Or the representation.
Like in Beauty and the Beast? Or is that too... does that cross a line into something else?
That would be anthropomorphism.
Really?
So anthropomorphism is the attribution of human characteristics or behaviors to an animal, object, or god.
So what's the difference between those two? I'm confused.
Yeah, so another way to look at it is anthropomorphism is literal. So speaking animals... or objects who talk, think, okay, or behave like animals are all anthropomorphic. So think of Thomas the Tank Engine, Winnie the Pooh, Beast from Beauty and the Beast.
When I say, when I attribute human characteristics to my dog, I am personifying.
That's personification.
Well, we as ecologists have been using anthropomorphism wrong for a long time, man. I mean, it depends who you're talking about. If you're talking about, like, oh... you know, the ecologist message of, look at this orca playing with her food, isn't this gross? Then that is personification. But if you're talking about, you know, Smokey the Bear, that's anthropomorphism, yes, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. So we got that bit right.
Finally, I'm going to talk about two tools that most of us utilize in our daily speech or writing, but we don't actually know the term for it. So the two terms are synecdoche and metonymy.
Can we maybe spell that first
yes.
one?
S-Y-N-E-C-D-O-C-H-E.
Synecdoche.
I've heard the term cynic douche before.
You're a cynic douche.
But that might be like a suburb of New... It is! It's a suburb of New York, fuck's sake.
All right, so synecdoche is a figure of speech by which a part is put out for the whole, such as hired hand for worker. The whole for a part, such as society for high society, the species for the genus for the species, or the name of the material for the thing made, such as boards for a stage. And then metonymy is a figure of speech consisting of the use of the name of one thing for that of another, of which it is an attribute or that is associated with. So meaning crown can be used for king or queen. Or the Shakespearean phrase, lend me your ears, is a call for the audience's attention made using metonymy. Since ears are not actually part of attention, but are associated with paying attention. So another common example is the use of an author's name to refer to the works written by that person. So like, we are studying Hemingway. You're not actually studying Hemingway, you're studying his literary works. So that's metonymy.
I found some really cool examples of
synecdoche.
Yeah, that people might be really familiar with. So to hit the bottle, like you're drinking the liquor in the bottle, but you're talking about the whole contents using the bottle. Or to a keg. Yeah, to do a keg, like it's the beer in the keg. Plastic for a credit card. And apparently, I didn't know this, but cement for concrete, because cement is just like the thing that binds the concrete together. Also, saying your Twitter is also an example of a synecdoche, because it's your Twitter account, right?
You keep using that word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
Okay, do we feel bad for this monster?
Yes.
Or monsters? Yes.
Yeah.
You do?
Poor. I mean, he was just, he's potentially trying to protect his territory. He, or she, was just working on a wolf. All right, it had worked hard. It was trying to bring that prey in, potentially, or just defending its territory. And suddenly there's all these other people with bright lights that are pissing it off. And then to finish it all off, some asshole sets it on fire and then beats it with a stick.
Yeah. I was just thinking when you said he or she, of that maybe they had to have it like outside of the ambulance when she set it on fire, because it was inside. You'd have to have a front-on shot of it like squatting on its haunches and it's got a big old dick dangling down.
Probably wouldn't be the dick, but the testicles? Yeah, big old scrotum hanging down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Predominance.
Yeah, I don't know. I do feel... I mean, at a certain point, you know, you can just fuck off. Like, it's clearly, like, there's lots of cars, there's lots of people. This thing is really trying very hard to protect its territory. I think it's overdoing it, and it needs to just take a bit of a chill pill, mosey on back into the woods, and hope that all these people have gone away when it comes to it.
You say that the next time that a vagrant breaks into your house, sets up on your couch, and Sam keeps trying to get it out, and the vagrant's just like, oh, this fucking Sam guy just won't leave me alone. Just take a chill pill, go somewhere else. I'm here right now. I'll probably move on.
See, I had a different take with the monster. I felt like the monster was a total sociopath and just playing with him the entire time, you know, because you see him standing, or he or she or it, standing behind the girl, and then being creepy and then fading into the background. You see him toying with Jesse by ripping his arm off, letting him go, and then pulling him under the truck. You see them playing with the mother and daughter by throwing Jesse's arm perfectly onto the truck just to freak them out. I mean, this monster knew what it was doing.
Either that or it's a cat. It's just a big fucking cat.
I like it.
Which it could have been. I think I'm halfway between. If it was one monster, I don't feel bad for it, because like Libby said, it was a sociopathic asshole. But if it was a pack of monsters and they were just trying to, you know, have some food for the night and maybe feed their babies back home in whatever cave or den they live in, then no, it's just an animal being an animal. And you picked the wrong night to break down.
Maybe it's the real father.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's just like playing dress up because, you know, nobody's going to believe that story. It's like, this is the way to get custody.
Yeah. Or maybe...
And not play child support.
Or maybe...
By mauling my ex-partner to death.
Throwing this theory out there. It has been told that many actors will go full method for their roles. If Scott Speedman was still in underworld mode, and he's just never left it. He's been stuck in it for all these years, and they brought him on for like this tiny little part in this movie about a mother and a daughter finally getting to know each other and work through their childhood trauma. And then they just found Scott Speedman in a full werewolf outfit, just running around lunging at the car all the time. And they're like, well, we can't get him off the set, so we might as well change the direction this film is going to go in.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was just supposed to be a nice little, you know, family comedy before that.
Yeah.
Would we recommend this movie?
Yeah.
I would.
I wouldn't. I'm break for the pack. I would not.
Yeah, so next week we'll be kicking off our Fantastic Beasts bonanza, looking at not one, not two, but all three of the Fantastic Beasts movies. And why couldn't you just call it The Wizarding War? I don't know. Why can't J.K. Rowling be a good person? I also don't know. But that's what we'll be starting off next week. And remember, the monsters aren't real. The monster isn't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.